I didn't want to join up, no. No, I came from a very sheltered family, and I was the youngest of three brothers. I didn't want to go, but it was a case of had to. I mean, why should I go out and kill somebody I never knew? For what reason? There was no reason at all in it, in my way of thinking. I was put on the Lewis gun. Number two. Number one had the gun, number two the spare parts, and the other three were ammunition carriers. You were a team, and that was it.
It's the 11th of November, 2008, the 90th anniversary of the armistice that marked the end of the fighting from the Great War. It's a cold November day, and I'm standing in a large crowd in London's Whitehall, staring at the cenotaph. A few minutes later, the annual ceremony is held to remember those that died, not just in the Great War, but in other conflicts as well. And in the distance, in amongst the crowd, as I'm 6 foot plus, I can see over everyone's heads, and I can see three very old men in wheelchairs, alone in their thoughts, holding a wreath, which is taken off them by serving servicemen, and laid at the foot of the cenotaph. They are 112-year-old Henry Allingham, Bill Stone, who was 108, and Harry Patch, the last fighting Tommy, who at that stage was 110 years old. And then we stood there as the two-minute silence was held. Unusually, there was a round of applause for those three veterans at the end of the ceremony. There was a little bit of winter sunshine. It was the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. As the ceremony came to an end, those three men left the scene. They were taken through the gates of Downing Street and into number 10 Downing Street, where a reception was held in their honour. And as they disappeared out of sight, I thought to myself, would they be here next year? Would they see another year to remember their fallen comrades from the Great War? The answer was no. Henry Allingham was to die in July of 2009. Bill Stone died just a few weeks later after the ceremony that I'd witnessed in January of 2009. And Harry Patch, had become so well known to people throughout the world because of the book, The Last Fighting Tommy, that Richard Van Enden had written with him and also from his numerous television appearances. He died, aged 111, on the 25th of July 2009. So this was indeed the final time that the Great War veterans were seen in public. We were closing the book on direct access to the people that witnessed the horrors of the Great War. And it was now to be our job, our task, our mission, to make sure that they were never forgotten, that their memory and legacy was to live on. And Harry said, at some stage, the best memorial for the likes of me would be to look after the soldiers who are still fighting for their country now, and equally importantly, their families. And I don't know why, but those words struck a chord with me, and it was his death, I suppose, and those words that made me want to do something for the soldiers that were still fighting, like he said, today. And a few years later, I was to become a volunteer fundraiser for the Army Benevolent Fund, the soldiers' charity. And the task of raising money for the soldiers, veterans and their families, for me, that will never end until my life comes to an end. The image in my mind's eye, of seeing those three very old men disappearing through the gates of Downing Street, that will stay with me forever. And in this week's episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, I'm very fortunate to be able to talk to Harry's friend and biographer, Richard Van Emden, who joined me to talk about his memories of Harry. But we're also going to hear from Harry himself. I'm going to play clips to you from the various interviews that he did with TV documentaries in those last few years of his life. But I think what we'll do is start at the end. This is a news report that was recorded when Harry died, and it gives us a very good summary of Harry's life.
Harry Patch, the last British soldier to have fought in the trenches of World War One, has died, aged 111. Born on the 17th of June 1898, Harry Patch grew up near Bath. He left school aged 15 to become a plumber. He was 16 when war broke out and reached 18 as conscription was being introduced. So, after 6 months' training, he was sent to the front line. In September 1917, he was injured in a shell attack which killed three of his comrades. Sent back home to recover, he met his first wife, Ada, to whom he was married for nearly 60 years. In later life, he remarried, launched poppy appeals, and became an agony uncle for FHM. Harry Patch may be famous as a war hero, but having witnessed the horrors at Passchendaele firsthand, he was vehemently anti-war.
Let us remember our brethren who fell. They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn.
The Prince of Wales and Prime Minister Gordon Brown have led the tributes to a man known affectionately as the Last Tommy. He had become Britain's oldest man for just a few days after the death of Henry Allingham a week beforehand. Harry's friend Jim Ross has described him as being as tender as a poppy. Britain may remember Harry Patch as a soldier, but those who loved him most will remember him as a dear friend.
So when we talk to Richard in a minute, we'll be discussing the book, The Last Fighting Tommy, that he wrote with Harry. And been reading the book again in the last few days. And Harry talks about Harry was conscripted in 1916. He said, in June of 1916, I turned 18 years of age, and from that time onwards, I knew that a telegram requiring my service was only months or perhaps weeks away. Notification came by post, and with it a railway warrant from Bath to Taunton to report by such and such a time on the following day. This would have been around October of 1916, and five of us from the village went down from Bath to Tolland Barracks. Here we were roughly kitted out and our civilian clothes sent home. Then, after a few days, it was off to Exmouth, where we did our basic training, squad drill out on the square, with route marches to build up our strength and stamina. Quite early on, I was picked out for reasons unbeknown to me and made a lance corporal and given a stripe. That was in the winter of 1916-17, one of the coldest that I can recall. And we used to go down to the sand dunes to do physical training, and it was perishing. We did square bashing, left and right turns, about turn, and we were glad of the physical exercise, just to keep warm. But it was to be the summer of 1917 that Harry arrived at Ypres, which is where he spent his entire time on the Western Front, about 3.5 months. This is what he said it was like.
We were always told that when we were going up or coming back, if a fellow fell into a shell hole which had filled with water, leave him there. And if any man tells you he ever went to France and went in the front line, I tell you he wasn't scared, then he's a damn liar. I think every man that went in the front line at some time or another was scared. I know I was.
Well, we'll hear more from Harry later as he describes what it was like to go over the top and the steam peak in August, and then what happened when he was wounded, badly wounded, in the following month in September of 1917. But let's now begin playing the interview with Richard, and he tells us about his memories of his great friend, Harry. Thank you for joining us on the podcast, Richard. Came on a couple of years ago to talk about boy soldiers, and as I said, I'd like to talk to you, if we can, about your experiences of meeting that last fighting Tommy, the famous Harry Patch. But I know he still means a lot to you, doesn't he? Even though it's what, 16, 17 years now after he died?
Yes, 2009. Both he and Henry Allingham went within a week of each other in
Yeah.
July. And it doesn't seem possible. I mean, it just doesn't seem possible. All those years have passed since he died. He's so still in my mind so clearly. His voice, I hear his voice so easily too. And it's 17 years. Wow, how time flies. But yeah, he was. And I've been interviewing the children now, or the grandchildren of those who fought, which is another aspect of the Great War, to keep the Great War going.
That's a good
But
idea.
that
Yeah.
generation has gone. Yeah, I mean, I've got some amazing interviews which I want to
Yeah.
use at that point. But yeah, that generation totally gone. There's only one Edwardian left in the whole of the United Kingdom as well. So
Yeah.
it is now history.
It is, isn't it? And how did you get to meet Harry in the first place? Was it just a phone call to his nursing home?
Yes, but it came off the back of a magazine. I used to someone t tipped me off about an industry caring industry magazine called the Caring Times, and they used to run a little happy birthday section to centenarians. So basically, some person at a home would put in the name, go, Mrs. Mavis Davis of such and such a home in Cirencester is 100, and they would just say happy birthday to this lady in this column, and every now and again, a man's name would appear. So I took out a subscription to the Caring Times on the basis that every now and again I'll pick up a 100-year-old bloke and I can ring the home and see if he's a veteran. And then one day it said, "Happy birthday, 100-year-old Harry Patch, Fletcher House, Wells," in the magazine. I rang the home and said, "Did he serve in the war?" "Yes, he did." "Would he talk to me?" "Yes, he by all means." And that's how that relationship started.
But he hadn't spoken about it until then in any
No,
depth.
I've not spoken to anybody, not his wife, not anybody, as far as I'm aware. He certainly gave me the impression he'd never spoken to about it. He never joined the Legion. He didn't want anything to do with the kind of any sort of memory of the war.
Yeah.
And so it was very clear. That first time we spoke about this war for about 5 minutes. I mean, he met me. We walked up to his bedroom. He said, "We'll go and talk up there." He was fit as anything. I mean, he did have a walking stick, but he didn't need it. We went up to his room and he talked for about 5, 10 minutes. He said, "I think that's everything I can tell you." And I said, and I could see it was really weighing heavily on him.
Yeah.
And I said, "Can I ask a few questions then?" And he sort of said, "Okay." So as I started to ask questions, a bit more came out, a bit more came out. But as he always said to me, "Look, I did 3.5 months on the Western Front. It wasn't that long enough for him, but he said I never went through a Somme winter or anything like that. So a
No.
lot of guys went through a lot worse than I did, but he was at Passchendaele, which was bad enough, and he was wounded and lost his friend. So he definitely had a story to tell, but it was very, very difficult for him to tell it because he was so unused to speaking about it. And
Yeah.
it was only because, I mean, I said to him one time, I said, "Well, why did you even speak to me?" He said, "I don't really know." He said, "You just called," and I just thought, "Well, why not?"
Wonder if he was unloading a lot of people, older people, not just war veterans, but a lot of people want to talk about their life in the final stages of their life, don't they?
Yeah, I always talk about this 2 minutes to 12, this clock, that if they don't speak about it now, they'll take it to the grave. And sometimes they want their family to get at least some idea of what they went through, what they did. With him, I think, yeah, it was just unloading. I mean, he even right at the end of his life, he started telling me another story which he'd never spoken about, but really horrific. And I just went, "Oh, Harry, you don't need to tell me this now." It was
No.
so close to the end, and I was like, "Well, I'll listen if you want to tell me." But he kind of thought about it, and I know what he was talking about. He
He
said he.
trusted you, didn't he? He trusted you, and you become a good friend.
Yeah, I mean, his book had already been written then, so it was an addition. It was basically battlefield clearance and carrying headless corpses. I mean, that's what the story was. But he'd never spoken to me about it before, and it hadn't gone in the book, obviously, because I didn't know
No,
about it.
you're already done.
And he just suddenly just sort of wanted to talk about it. But then when I sort of said, "Look, you don't need to talk, it's up to you, Harry," he kind of went, "Okay," and left it.
Did
And
he?
that was literally like maybe a month before he died or something.
Really? And then we arrive at the 16th of August, a date that Harry said doesn't mean much to him because it was 6 weeks before he was actually wounded. But this is a key date in the Battle of Passchendaele, the Third Battle of Ypres. It's what's known as the Battle of Langemarck. And Harry and his battalion were involved in an attack on the fortified remains of that town of Langemarck. That's across the Steenbeek. As we'll see later, that's where the memorial to Harry is located. But this is what he remembers about that awful day.
I was 18 and a half, and I was called up. I saw two battlefields, one at Passchendaele and one at Pilkem. I shall never forget it as long as I live. The officer was going down the trench. Anybody who didn't go in was shot on sight for cowardice. We went over and we crawled. If you stood up, you were dead. And I came across a Cornishman. He was ripped from his shoulder to his stomach with shrapnel. His inside was out on the ground in a pool of blood. He said, "Shoot me." Before we could draw a revolver to shoot him, he was beyond all human aid. He died. In 30 seconds he died, and he just said one word, "Mother." And that haunted me all my life. Out of the trench, there was about four or five Germans got out. And they didn't get out to run, they got out to fight. And one of them was coming towards us with a fixed bayonet. He couldn't have had any ammunition, or else he'd have shot us. As I say, I was a crack shot. I shot him in the shoulder. I couldn't kill him. That Cornishman's mother was in my brain. I thought, I can't kill him. He's somebody's son. He's probably got brothers and sisters. Maybe he's got a family to bring up. I can't kill him. I shall never forget it.
Even in his private life after both World Wars, he'd encountered a lot of personal tragedy as well, didn't he, with his own family. And that affected him.
Yeah, I mean, he'd had one of his sons served in the Second War and was an alcoholic. And I mean, again, I didn't really pursue any of that because I just thought it's obviously painful for him. His son had sold off everything, I think, pretty much. I think including Harry's medals. So Harry's medals are somewhere. I mean, he wore the medals of a man called Ray, his Mutt and Jeff, those two. And he... I looked at CJ Ray, I think, a chap who died in Cardiff in the 1950s. So someone had picked those up in a second-hand shop for him, and that's what he wore.
He wore someone else's
medals. Are out there somewhere. Someone's got, a very, very expensive two medals in their collection, and I've no idea it's Harry Patch's, because they'd be worth, well, I mean, you're probably talking four figures for those, given who Harry
definitely was. Yeah, their history. And I think reading through his book again in the last few days and watching the documentaries that you did, and I'll play clips of it on the podcast so people can hear it, his, not only is he remembered for being the last fighting Tommy, I think that his thoughts, the clarity of his thoughts and the deepness, the depth of his thoughts make him so interesting, isn't it? Because he's different. His thoughts on the war and the impact on human beings and on the enemy is different to other accounts I've heard from people.
Yeah, I mean, we were incredibly fortunate. The last surviving veteran was completely on the ball, had his eyesight, pretty decent hearing. I mean, he could have been bedridden, blind and incontinent and senile, easily. And he wasn't any of those things.
No.
So we got, we were able to tap into a remarkable memory and tap into the personality of an individual and his thoughts on the war. I think they were a little bit overinterpreted. I think people kind of played him slightly as this kind of almost like quasi pacifist, and he wasn't that.
No,
I think people like to sort of take the words that he spoke about. We're all human beings, and this war is always ends round a table. And why didn't we do that before the fighting starts? There's some sort of thing. And it wasn't quite like that. It was a bit overinterpreted. But equally, he really did feel the abomination of war very deeply.
Yeah.
And he never wanted to go. But he said, his elder brother had been an old contemptible, had been invalided out in 1915. I think 15 or early 16. And he came back and told Harry all about it. And Harry
so went, he knew what he was in for.
He knew exactly what he was going into. And he didn't want to go, but he was, he wasn't going to refuse. And when he was called up, he went, but he hated it.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. And what was it like then when you actually took him out there that last time? So how many times did you go with him out to the battlefield?
Probably four.
Quite a few times.
The first time was 2003 when he could barely get off the bus. We went up to Pilcombe Ridge and he was bits, absolute bits. And he really struggled that first occasion.
Emotionally, not physically.
Oh, emotionally, yeah. He really, he was... Never ever thought he'd go back. I'd asked him maybe 10 years before that, would you ever countenance going back? And he said, no, never. So he was absolutely adamant. And then as time went on and we talked about his story, and not 10 years earlier, sorry, 2003, sorry, maybe three or four years earlier. But as time went on, we wrote his book and we talked about it all. He then came to the idea. So we went probably four times. And that last time was extraordinary because, he was 110, and
he knew it was going to be his last visit then, didn't he? I suppose at that time.
At that time he was in bad shape because he went to the Cenotaph that November and he looked great.
I was there when you were there. Three of them, I was there. And then they went off into Downing Street for lunch, didn't they? Yeah, I was there.
I was lucky to join them. I was very happy to do that. Never will go into Downing Street again. That's my one opportunity. But so he was really well. He was amazing because he got up at like 4 a.m. To get up to London. We had an amazing situation that I rang, I can't remember who I spoke to, and I said, look, he's going to come up in a car. What happens if he's going to hit the rush hour? You want him at the Cenotaph at 11. He needs to be up there by 10 at the later. What happens if we can't get him through? And then I said, can I drive him on the inside lane if I'm in the car? And they said, well, you can, but you'll get 12 points. So I was like, okay. So I rang a national newspaper and said, this is what's going to happen. He's going to get stuck in traffic. I just know it. Last Great War veteran. He can't get to the Cenotaph.
Can't happen.
And they said, well, we'll send a motorcycle guy out with a camera and we'll photograph him in the backseat of the car sitting there like, oh my God, he can't get to the Cenotaph. And we'll run that last veteran, humiliation of this. And then lo and behold, suddenly he got the executive, somebody called and said, oh, there's going to be a car, there'll be motorcycle outriders, they'll get him through.
As it should be, because he's represented not just himself, but the 5 million that fall, isn't
he? Yeah, exactly. But clearly that national newspaper had spoken to the right people and suddenly... You get it for diplomats and terrorists, I believe, these four outriders. They took him through. He said he went past Harrods the wrong way on the wrong side of the street and all these people were looking. He said it was amazing. So he was actually really fit then and he was really fit. That was in November and then obviously. And then I went to see him in January and I was really shocked. It was a couple of months I didn't see him and I was really shocked. He'd lost a load of weight and I was like, Harry, you need to eat. I don't know what's going on. But he was finally wearing out.
Yeah.
By sort of June, July, you could see he was in his bedroom all the time, didn't come more. He did occasionally, if he felt well, he sort of got dressed. And the last time, well, virtually the penultimate time I saw him, it was the last time he was out of bed. And you could see he was at the end. But even then, that last time that he was out of bed sitting there, and I took the last ever photograph of Harry. And I said, how are you feeling? And he said, oh, not great, And then he said, but, and he pulled out his passport and he said, but
it's there. Belgium.
And I've written my memoirs, by the way. I've almost finished them, it sounds really poncy, but all my life with these veterans, all the amazing stories. And this is one of them that features in the thing is he took out his passport and he sort of said, I'd go back. And I was like, oh, Harry, you're in no
small order.
And I went down to see the owner and the person who ran the home. And she said, if he wants to go, he can go. We would never stop him, but he won't make it back. He won't survive the journey.
No.
So it's obvious we couldn't take him. But I actually think, and this is only my own personal point of view, I actually think he knew he was almost finished, and I think he wanted to die out there. I really do.
And be with his mates from the Lewis Gunn team.
Yeah, just die out on Pilcombe Ridge. Where better place to go than, you know, he loved being in the home he was in. It was fine, you know, everything like that. But I cannot believe he seriously thought, I want to go to Belgium again and then come back. Such a poor state of health. I think he kind of thought, you know, I'm happy to go. And he died maybe 12 days after that.
Oh, really? Something. It was as soon as that?
Yeah, yeah. It was the penultimate time. So I saw him about the 13th of July, I think. And then I saw him on the 22nd or 23rd, and he died on the 25th. So, yeah, it was just as that. So she was right. He would never have made it.
Yeah, yeah. As you say, we'll never know, will we? But part of his spirit will still be out there with those lads in from his Lewis Gunn team, won't they?
His
spirit will always be there, like they all are.
So let's go back now and hear what Harry has to say about the day that he was wounded, the 22nd of September 1917.
We did two or three turns in the trenches, and we were going back on one of those turns when somebody pulled the lanyard of a gun, fired a whiz-bang, landed right in amongst us. It killed 3, 4, and 5. It wounded me. And I, piece of shrapnel, it must have hit something in the ground or something hard. It's 2 inches long, 1/2 inch wide, jagged edge, hit me in the groin. It was only a scratch, really. You could see it. And I must have passed out. I don't know how long I lay there. The next thing I knew, I was in a dressing station. And the doctor came the next evening. I took the bandage off. He said, "But do you like me to take that shrapnel out?" Now, he said, "Before you say yes, there's no anaesthetic in the camp." So I thought for a minute. So, well, I don't know. The pain was intense. Says, "Yes, go on, getting out. How long will you be?" He said, "2 minutes." I could have bloody killed him in those 2 minutes. But anyway, he got it out. And he said, "Do you want this as a souvenir?" I said, "I've had the bloody stuff long enough as it is." The next thing I knew, they called my number, my name. I was put in a Red Cross van down to Rouen and back to England. That was it.
And that made me think about that last visit, when you did the last visit, and he was sitting in his wheelchair looking at the battalion's names on the Time Cross Memorial, and you walked and left him there, and he was alone in his own deep thoughts, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, we never got to know who his pals were. He never said their names.
Could he not remember their names, do you think, or he just didn't want to?
I don't know. Do you know? I'm not sure. He used to talk about the one who survived being the head man.
Yeah.
And so he then got back to me years later saying, I found out who this guy was. And absolutely, everything fits. So he remembered, but again, he never told me his name. He just said he lived in Henley.
Right.
And someone then set up, decided they were going to discover who this guy was. And they found him. So, but I don't know. I just don't know.
No.
He did say a couple of names very early on. And either I didn't take note of them or the name changed slightly or something. And I just kind of parked those. He didn't follow up on that particularly.
Just leaving the interview there, I mentioned to Richard about that last trip with Harry, when Harry went up to Tynecott, not for the first time, but sat looking at the missing on the memorial to the missing that surrounds Tynecott Cemetery. And he was staring at the names on the memorial to the men from his regiment, the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry. And it occurred to Harry that it could be that his mates that he lost that day are buried in Tynecott. perhaps lying beneath a headstone that says known unto God, brought in from the battlefield after the armistice. But if they are still missing, of course we don't know who they are, then their names will be on that memorial that Harry was looking at. And these were his thoughts as he sat there, thinking about those mates from long ago.
September the 22nd, 10:30 at night. That's when I lost them. That's my remembrance day.
In September of 2008, there was a special memorial unveiled by Harry himself in a private ceremony when only a few people were there. And this memorial was in fact to Harry's comrade in the 7th Battalion of the Duke of Cornwall Light Infantry. On that memorial, there's a plaque, and on the plaque it says, "Here at dawn on the 16th of August 1917, the 7th Battalion, Duke of Cornwall Light Infantry, crossed the Steenbeek prior to the successful assault on the village of Langemark. This stone is erected to the memory of fallen comrades and to honour the courage, sacrifice and passing of the Great War generation. It is the gift of former private and Lewis gunner Harry Patch, number 29295 C Company, 7th DCLI, the last surviving veteran to have served in the trenches of the Western Front." Within 12 months of opening that memorial, which is still there, it was lost for a time, it was found and is now back where it should be. Within a year of that, Henry's long life had come to an end.
And the idea of the memorial?
I don't know. It seems to come out of the ether. I don't know. He wanted to pay for it because he was getting royalties from his book.
Yes.
So he said, I don't think it was Harry, to be fair. I think somebody said, you know, it would be amazing. Because obviously we could locate that memorial and exactly the spot that he crossed the Steenbeek. So it was the most beautifully located. It's the most accurately located memorial on the Western Front, without a shadow of a doubt. It's even now it's been moved about a metre to the left. It's made it even more accurate because there was a little pontoon bridge that he crossed over and it was on that corner. There's a little corner there. So I don't think he went, oh, well, it'd be really nice to put a memorial there. I suspect somebody fed him the idea or somebody mentioned it to him. I can't remember that so long ago. It just seemed to appear.
Yeah.
The one thing he said was, I want to buy it. I want to pay for it.
Yeah.
And well, fine, you know, you've plenty of money to do that now. And then we wrote the words and sort of talked to him about what he wanted to say. And we then moulded the words to his thoughts. And that's what's on there now.
Yeah. But it's the second memorial that's there now. And the
No, it's the original.
It got the original one back.
Apparently the original one came back, disappeared under very dubious circumstances, reappeared. By which time they cut another one, but it wasn't actually brilliantly cut. And they put that one there. And apparently the second one has gone back to Toc H, which is in their little museum there.
Oh, right.
The original one is now back on its
now. Oh, fantastic. Well, I didn't realise that. Yeah.
Apparently,
Because at one point you thought it was actually in the Steenbeek, didn't you?
that was the room. Nobody knew. I mean, it was just it was weird. It just disappeared. And I think it was some sort of, God knows who it was. But whoever it was, they obviously felt a bit guilty and
returned it
back again.
Yeah.
And so it is from Jeremy, doing a lot of work with on that. He's the one who said it's the original one back in situ now. So that's really great.
Right.
If you go and see it, I've not been back. If you go and see it and it's really badly cut, then you know it's the second one because the spacing wasn't quite right and it was a bit cramped at one point. If it's beautifully spaced and
I think it is. I think you're right. I think it is the first one because when we go on Terry's tours in a car, it's easy for us to get into that lay-by and see it. When you're on a coach tour, it's more difficult, isn't it? So coach tours don't tend to go there to see it. But whenever we go, because we always pass there, whenever you go on a tour, you go to Langemark and you come out there and you always pass that location. People think, oh, why are we going down this little lay-by? And then when they get out and see his photograph there and the memorial, there's a look of stunned surprise in people's faces. This is where Harry went over the top.
And that, duck ball track that led up to it, you can follow it on the maps and it arrives right at that spot. And it's extraordinary, because any other memorial you kind of go, well, it could be 20 yards that way or 50 yards that way. We don't know what it's about here. This is like absolutely, I mean, there's a photograph of that pontoon in the divisional history, which shows the pontoon on that corner, the one that he spoke about.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very honored to welcome you here at the borders of the Steenbeek for the unveiling of the memorial to commemorate soldiers and victims of every war. I would thank Mr. Harry Patch for this monument and his permanent efforts for bringing the consequences of war under public attention.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Do you like it?
Yeah.
You do? That's good, isn't it? I'm very pleased.
Yeah.
Oh, and then the last thing I wanted to ask you about was when you his feelings about the enemy, the Germans. And, you know, there was a wonderful video of him meeting a German soldier. And the thing that really got to me was when you took him to Langemark, picking up the acorns from the trees.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, he again was very much into sort of life from death sort of thing. And he really wanted to go to Langemark, find a grave where there was at least one soldier who died on the 16th of August, the day he went over the top.
Yeah.
And while he was there, he spied these acorns at the side of those plinths. And he said, right, well, I would like to take those back and bury those in the garden at Fletcher House, and from it, life will grow. So he was quite into his symbolism, Harry.
Yeah.
Quite like that. So no one fed him that idea. That was his own idea to do that. And you know, I've not been back to Fletcher House in 15 years, so I imagine it, if they grew, they'll be, I don't know, 12 feet tall now.
There was one more stop on his pilgrimage. Under the oak trees in Langemark Cemetery are the graves of 40,000 German soldiers. For Harry, they were once enemies, but now they were comrades. Before leaving, Harry took some acorns from the earth.
Give me those two on the corner.
Back at home in Somerset, Harry had a future in mind for the acorns that he had collected in Belgium.
That's all. They'll grow. I know you live today as we did in the trench. One hour to the next. That's how we were, the trenches. We never knew when we went over the top if there was something come along with your number on it.
There was one other special location that they went to on that final tour with the cameras in tow, and that was Talbot House in Poppering, the base town that was behind the lines on the Passchendaele battlefield, a place that British soldiers called a second home, a real home from home, a refuge from the dreadful battlefield just a few miles away, and a place where soldiers could find a place to escape that dreadful reality of the war. We visited Talbot House, one of the first episodes that we did in 2022 on the podcast. You can go back and listen to that. But as I say, it was in the garden that Richard spoke to Harry during this documentary, and he perhaps gave his final reflections for us all to think about.
You just be able to sign in there. That's wonderful stuff.
You never know. You might have been here this day. On that particular day, you might just have been in the other room or in the garden.
But isn't it beautiful? It's so, so quiet.
'Tis now. Not when I knew it. You could hear the guns. You never knew where one was going to fall short. That was a bug robin.
Yeah. It just shows that life is continuing in Harry's honour, really, isn't it? And
yes. You know,
And the fact that we're talking about him, and people can still get your book, it's still freely available, isn't it, everywhere?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Yeah, well, I don't know how many bookshops it's in now. It's still, I mean, it is still sell. I mean, it still sells in the sort of low hundreds in a year, yeah. Even now, all these years on.
Yeah.
Maybe 300 or 400 copies a year, something like that, hardback and softback, which is remarkable for somebody who's been dead 17 years.
And you wrote it in 2007, so it's 19... Yeah, that's when it was published, yeah. 2007, yeah. So getting on for 20 years.
Sold a bucket loads in 7, 8, 9, and then after he died, it sold for the next 6 months, it went ballistic. And then, because of course, he was like a... I never foresaw this, but he was like a one-man publicity machine. So he would go to, you know... some event somewhere, and if the cameras were that 70, whatever, the 90th anniversary of Passchendaele at the Royal Albert Hall, and the Queen was there, and Harry's wheeled on, and he then holds the book and gives it to the Queen and says, "Here's a copy of my book." I mean, you can't buy that publicity.
No,
straight up the charts. I never saw it. I think he may have got to number one in all Amazon books. He was at number two for about 3 or 4 weeks. And I kept looking, and I kept looking, going, come on, Harry, get to number one. I never saw him at number one.
Oh.
But I like to imagine at 2 a.m. on a Thursday morning somewhere, he got into the number one and dropped down when I wasn't looking.
You should have got him to sing a song. He'd have got to number one in the hip charts.
Exactly, yeah. Well, Roger Walters of Pink Floyd used his voice, didn't he? Oh, no, it wasn't Roger. No, it wasn't. It was, Radiohead.
They That's used, right. Yes, you heard that. Yeah, I was going to play that.
Yeah. Yeah, so yes, he got everywhere. It's remarkable.
Well, he'll always live on in your memory, won't he? And he's going to feature in your memoirs.
Yes. Well, my son, he's got his third name is Harry.
Oh, really?
His first name is Ben, after Ben Clouting, who was an old contemptible and a great, great friend of mine, who was at the first shot of the Great War, which was a remarkable story in itself.
Yeah.
And so... yes, his first and third names are connected Brilliant. To Great War veterans.
Right.
So, it's fantastic.
Well, there's lots more of these to talk about in the future, so maybe we could catch up with some people like him in the future. Because I found that people have been interested in since I started doing this podcast. You know, there's other podcasts that talk about, you know, the tactics and the set battles and all that, but it's these individual stories that really bring it all, as you know, brings it
well,
all
Well, there's one right behind me, that lady there.
I was wondering about her.
Yes, from my book Missing, which is about her search for her son who went missing
on the
top of 18. And, you know, she spends 5 years looking for him, being told she won't find him, and she finds him.
Yes.
That's one of the remarkable stories I've ever come across.
Yes.
And, then the family were flogging the picture. I said, I've got to buy that. So she sort of watches over me every time I write a book.
And is that a painting?
Yes, a painting. Yeah. It's a full-length painting of her. Yeah. Yeah,
that could be our next one then.
That
be our next one. Talk about her story.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. Absolutely extraordinary story of her search for her son is mind-blowing.
No, and that's right. I've read that once, twice.
And her brother-in-law was the man who signed off on the cenotaph. He was director of work in Lloyd George government. So,
yes.
The connections are just amazing.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Oh, I'm really grateful for this, Richard. Thanks very much for coming on.
And, pleasure.
We'll come back and we'll talk about that lady another time then, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
On the 6th of August 2009, the funeral of Harry was held in the Somerset town of Wells. His coffin was taken to the cathedral. There were so many people that wanted to attend. The service was relayed on big screens to the crowds outside. Harry's coffin left Fletcher House, where he lived those last few years. At 11:30 that morning, and arrived at the cathedral at noon, and the route was lined with many, many people and a number of standards, particularly from the British Legion. Soldiers carried his coffin, and they were followed by two soldiers from each of the armed forces, from Belgium, France and Germany. Harry's medals were carried by his great-nephew, a man called David Tucker, and members of the royal family were in attendance, the Duchess of Cornwall and the Duchess of Gloucester. At the end of the service, the coffin was carried outside the west doors of the cathedral, and that's where the last post was sounded. We can play a little bit of the service to you now, as we remember Harry ourselves.
We are here today to celebrate Henry John Patch. Harry, Somerset man, husband, father and grandfather, friend, plumber, last veteran of the trenches, ambassador for peace and reconciliation. Harry was an ordinary man. Harry let it out so we could hear his message of peace and reconciliation. I wouldn't have had the courage to make the decision Harry made. Would any of you? No.
Harry's body in the coffin was then taken to a small village called Monkton Combe. And there's a church there called St Michael's, and that's where you'll find his final resting place. He doesn't have a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. Of course he doesn't, because he didn't die during the war. He's buried in a private family grave. You wouldn't notice it necessarily, but the next time I head down to the southwest of England, I know that I'll be paying my respects to Harry and thinking of him. What I'd like to do this week is give the final word to Harry himself. The last couple of paragraphs in the book that he wrote with Richard go something like this. He says, and that's about it. The memories remain, of course. In the home right opposite my room upstairs, there's a linen cupboard, and the girls who are on night duty often go to store away folded sheets, and until recently, when I was lying in bed at night and the nurse switched the light on outside my room, if I was half asleep and half awake, I was back on that battlefield. There was a flash. Now the staff have blacked up that top window, so I don't have that problem anymore. What is the secret of a long life? No idea. I wish I could tell you. I'm happy, and that is all that concerns me today. I don't have any ambitions now. I'm glad to see my family and friends, and I'm glad I've had the chance to be reunited with relatives with whom I'd lost contact. Otherwise, it's one day at a time. They will have written their pieces in the paper for when I finally go. The last trench fighter has to be newsworthy. I've seen obituaries of other veterans, and there's now only Henry Allingham and myself in this country who served on the Western Front, and one British man in Australia. Can you imagine how it feels to be one of the last ones? Always hearing that another one has just died, then another and another. Waiting to hear who's gone and always wondering if you're next. Well, if they've written the obituary, all I can say is that I hope to live long enough that they will have to update it, and more than once. Then I can fade away. Isn't that what old soldiers are meant to do? And fade away is exactly what he did at the age of 111 in 2009. And as you know, we normally end the podcast by the sounding of the last post, and we're going to do that for Harry. But this particular recording of the last post was at his funeral. That's how we're going to end today, remembering Harry. Thank you.
shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.